You're listening to the weekly broadcast of Grace Church, an independent Bible teaching church in Wichita Falls, Texas. Each week, our Sunday morning teaching is presented by one of a team of pastors as we journey together through a book of the Bible, theological study, or life-related topic. Thanks for tuning in. Here's this week's message.
Well, last year in May, my wife and I decided to do something we had not done before. We decided to take a trip to the beach, and my wife grew up going to the beach, loved it, some of her favorite memories, and she just had a real appreciation for it. I, on the other hand, did not grow up going to the beach very much. It wasn't something that we did a lot, and I have what I like to call a healthy fear of the ocean, and so we compromised, and we went to the beach, and so we loaded our, it was a really fun trip, so I'm glad we went, but we loaded our kids up. At the time, 7 years old, 5 years old, 4 years old, 1 year old, into the car for an 8-hour road trip. I know. And so we load them up into the car, and my wife does everything she can to make this go as smoothly as possible, right? She gives them all this stuff to keep them entertained, gives them food so they don't get hungry, and inevitably, we don't get very far into this trip when we start to hear from the back seat exactly what you'd expect, right? Are we there yet? This is taking forever. We don't even want to go anymore. Can we just go back home, right? And this 8-hour trip stretches into like a 10 or 11-hour trip, and we have to stop for the bathroom. We have to stop because there's storms. But we finally get to Port Aransas. We get down there, and there's just a little bit of daylight left. And we get to our rental house, and we realize, look, we got two options here. So we can either go to the house, unpack everything, settle in, I can put the kids back in the bedroom, and I can just relax from a long day, which sounds great, or we can go to the beach. And so we decided, we're like, that's going to be way more fun, so let's do that. Let's go to the beach. We got a little bit of time left. Let's take the kids, and let's get to the beach. We've been on the road all this time. That's what we're here for. Let's go. And so there's this about quarter mile path from where we're staying out to the beach. And so you go down this long pathway, and then there's this boardwalk that goes up over the sand dunes before you get there. And so we're walking down this path, and our kids are just running around. You can tell they're so glad not to be in the car anymore, right? Stretching their legs, running, having a great time. And my 5-year-old son runs out ahead, and he's the first one up that hill. And he gets to the top of that hill, and we can see it on his face. He sees the ocean, right? And he stops, and he turns around, and he looks at us, and he goes, "I can see the sea." And then our daughters are not far behind him. They run up. They can see it. We see it on their faces. They're just in awe. It's the ocean. And we run down that hill together. We take off our shoes. We start running through the sand, letting the waves run over our feet. And they're just taking it all in. They're having a blast. And the whole trip was just great. They had so much fun. And while they didn't say it, I think that if you'd asked them, they would have admitted that long, excruciating car ride, it was worth it. Once they got there, once they saw the destination, they realized it was worth it. And I would submit to you that I think that when we are facing pain and hardship, when we're suffering, when we feel like we're on this car ride that will never end, I would say that we can endure any of that as long as we believe that there's purpose to our pain. And that, I believe, is the main idea of this section of the book of Philippians that we're going to read this morning. So if you have your copy of Scripture, we're in Philippians 1, continuing in this book. Caleb introduced us to the book of Philippians last week. It's a book where Paul is writing to the church in Philippi this encouragement, and we can see his affection for them in what we read last week. There was this sort of prayer of thanksgiving, and then in this section, Paul is going to turn his focus, and he's going to talk about the things that he's going through now. And he's going to write to update them about that. So he says in verse 12, he says, "I want you to know, brothers, that what has happened to me has really served to advance the gospel, so that it has become known throughout the whole imperial guard and to all the rest that my imprisonment is for Christ. And most of the brothers, having become confident in the Lord by my imprisonment, are much more bold to speak the word without fear. Paul begins by saying, what has happened to me has served a purpose. But what has happened to Paul? You know, Caleb said last week that Paul here, as he's writing, he is under house arrest. He's essentially in prison. But Paul, up to this point, has also been stoned and left for dead. He has been imprisoned for casting out demons. He's been chased out of Thessalonica for preaching the gospel. He has narrowly escaped public flogging and torture. He's had a plot against his life. And he's been shipwrecked in Malta. He's been through a lot. Now Paul is most likely here referring specifically to his imprisonment, but I think he could just as easily be talking about all the hardship that he has endured for the sake of the gospel. And his opening words are, I want you to know, brothers. It opens like a letter written to family members back home from the front lines of battle. And I wonder if you imagine that you yourself are in harm's way, and you have this opportunity, for all you know, it might be your last opportunity to write to the people that you love, to offer them some comfort, to update them about your condition. Like, what would you say? That is how Paul is writing. And remember who these people are to Paul. It's one of the first churches that he helped to establish. He has a deep affection for these people, and they do for him as well. I mean, you can imagine there's probably some people in this church that think of Paul as a sort of father figure. They love him, and they're probably anxiously awaiting a letter from Paul. They're worried about his condition. How is he? What's happening to Paul? They're ready to hear from him. And so what comfort does Paul offer them? He says that his suffering has served a purpose, served to advance the gospel. That is Paul's reassurance. That's how he comforts the people who are concerned about him. What has happened to me, the pain that I am in, has a purpose. Again, I think this is the very key to Paul's entire mindset. I think it's the heart of what we're going to see throughout this passage today. It is the belief that we can endure anything when we believe, or in Paul's case, when we know God has a purpose for our pain. That is where Paul is coming from. Paul says that even his captors see the purpose of his imprisonment. Even they recognize this is serving Christ. And listen, I understand that so often when we face painful circumstances, that purpose is not always immediately clear. But Paul writes with such conviction, he already sees it. He knows it's about advancing the gospel. He lived with this mission, this calling from God. He knew that's what he was here for. So why would his pain be any different? It's almost as if Paul is free from the burden of self-focus. He knows he's part of something bigger than himself. So he's free from the burden of self-focus. And doesn't that sound great? To be able to look at circumstances and not worry, this is how I feel, or this is what I need, or I wish this would happen. Paul's not worried about that. He has a different perspective. And so I see this and I think, man, that there's a couple ways that we could face extreme, painful circumstances. We can either focus on ourselves and how we feel about it, or we can focus on where God might be taking us and what he might be doing with it. And again, I will admit that's far easier said than done. When I was reading this, studying this, and I'm seeing that in the text, seeing that message come through, I'm going, that's intimidating. That's really tough. And I'm sure that I fail at this far more often than I get it right, but I can't escape it. I think that is what Paul is saying here. I think that's the example that he offers us. Paul seemed to know that not only would having the right mindset help him to endure this trial, but it was going to help those around him as well. So what purpose does Paul see in his imprisonment? He says, I'm able to preach the gospel to my captors. I'm able to share Jesus with the very people that have me here. And I'm able to encourage boldness in other believers that they can take the gospel beyond the walls of my prison. And if you've spent much time in church or around Christians, you maybe have heard the phrase sharing your testimony. And testimony is just a word that we use to describe the story of how a person came to faith, or maybe a story of how their faith helped them endure something. And so maybe you've shared your testimony publicly with someone. It's not really an ordinance in the same way that baptism or communion are, things that Jesus commanded the church to do, but it is nevertheless a very common thing that we do, and for good reason. For the last couple of summers here at Grace Church, we've had a series on Wednesday nights called Never Alone. And it's a time when we've invited people in our church family to stand up in front of others and share publicly a testimony of a time when they were facing something really difficult, some kind of painful circumstance, some trial. And they felt the pain of it, but they started to see how God was working. That in a time, in a season when it might otherwise feel like I'm just alone here, they realize God is moving in their life, that they're never alone. They're able to realize that God has a purpose for their pain. And when we sit and we listen to the testimony of another believer, hearing about the hardships that they faced, hearing about the way that their faith has grown, hearing about the way God has a purpose for their pain, can be one of the most inspiring and encouraging experiences that we can have. It strengthens our faith. And Paul knew that he was a living testimony for the people around him. And in verse 15, he goes on to say, "Some indeed preach Christ from envy or rivalry, but others from goodwill. The latter do it out of love, knowing that I am put here for the defense of the gospel. The former proclaim Christ out of selfish ambition, not sincerely, but thinking to afflict me in my imprisonment. What then? Only that in every way, whether in pretense or truth, Christ is proclaimed, and in that I rejoice." Paul mentions people who preach Christ from envy or rivalry, insincerely, for selfish ambition, even to make Paul mad, even to hurt Paul. And read that list of reasons to preach the gospel. It's not a good list. Those are not good reasons to preach the gospel. And I wish that I could stand here and say, like, I've never had an impure heart when I've stood up here and I've preached. I wish I could say that, but I can't. And when I read Paul describe somebody who does that, I'd expect him to have some pretty harsh words for him. You know, maybe say something like, you know, whatever you're preaching is worthless. You can't help anyone if that is the case. But that's not exactly what he does here. And it's because of his perspective. It's because Paul is looking at this in terms of how it affects him, right? He understands these people, they're trying, it's rivalry. They're trying to get at me. But guess what? All I see is how it feeds the bigger purpose here. All I see is that there are going to be people who hear the gospel, even if your motives are wrong, right? Even if you're doing it for the wrong reasons, all I'm worried about is that people are going to hear the gospel. That's what I'm focused on. Can you imagine being so team-focused, so mission-focused, not to even be bothered at all by the idea of somebody who does the same thing you do and does it better? Not bothered at all. It's an amazing amount of humility. Paul's example is the opposite of a self-focused life. And ultimately, rivalries, they're focused on results. What can I accomplish? And then how does that compare to the people around me? But as you've heard us say from this pulpit more than once in recent months, success in ministry specifically, or in walking with Jesus more broadly, success is based on faithfulness, not results. That's what Paul knew. Paul knew this is about faithfulness. I'm not worried about how many people I reach. I'm not worried about my number of conversions or anything like that. I'm worried about faithfulness. And if you're like me, maybe you've struggled with churches or church leaders whose motivations you didn't entirely trust. I know for me personally, when I look online at social media and I see some of these pastors and Bible teachers and they're making these videos, sometimes they're great. You know, sometimes they're really helpful. There's a lot of them out there that I really like and I appreciate and I learn from. Sometimes I come across ones though where I see them and I just get the sense that this person is just doing this for attention. This person just trying to build a following, get clicks, get likes. And when I see that, it frustrates me in a way that I can't describe. But whatever the case, if you've struggled with the motivations of somebody in the pulpit or in leadership, it's not new. Paul was aware of it. And what Paul didn't do is point to those people and go, listen, so the church thing, we had a good run. We tried it, but God didn't account for the egomaniacs, didn't account for the selfish people that would be doing it for the wrong reasons, and they've kind of ruined it for everybody. So church is canceled. We're done, right? It's not what Paul does. Paul's aware of those people. He knows they're out there, and he finds the good in it, and he never gives up on the church. And I don't think you or I should either. But I will say that I think, personally, this section still stands as a warning to me. Because what is apparent here is that it is possible to do the right thing for the wrong reason. I think we all know that. But I can preach the clearest and most articulate gospel message of my life, but I can still have selfishness in my heart when I do it. And I don't like that. And Paul's mindset here is he's more focused on the positive benefit. He's more focused on not being worried about how it affects him. But if Paul did want to address the person who's preaching that message under false pretenses, I do think he would have something to say to them. He says in 1 Corinthians chapter 13, he says, if I speak in tongues of men and angels, but I have not love, I'm a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. When Paul talks about this in a matter of self-reflection, he says, this is not where I want to be. I do not want to be somebody who can speak eloquently but not have love. And he carries this theme over even into this very epistle that we're reading now in Philippians. Just a few verses earlier, he tells the Philippians, it's my prayer that your love may abound more and more with knowledge and all discernment so that you may approve what is excellent and so be pure and blameless for the day of Christ, filled with the fruit of righteousness that comes through Jesus Christ to the glory and praise of God. I think Paul recognizes, yeah, if there's people out there trying to preach the gospel just to get at me because they're trying to one-up me, that's fine. They're preaching the gospel. People are going to hear the gospel. I'm okay with that. You know, it's not going to hurt me. But I know if I'm looking at myself and I'm trying to preach and I don't have love, there's a lot of benefits that I'm going to miss out on. That I'm going to miss out on the sanctifying work that happens with love. I'm going to miss out on some of the fruit of righteousness that comes from love. And I think it's, again, important to ask how Paul could have this disregard for rivalries. And it's all about that mindset. Because Paul is looking ahead. Paul is focused on the big picture, focused on what God is doing, even in his own present circumstances, that God can redeem where he's at right here and now. Because of that, rivalries don't mean much to Paul. Because of Paul's focus on redemption, rivalries are meaningless to him. And I wonder what that looks like in a much larger group of Christians, in a church body, where people can look at each other, not with jealousy or envy, not look at somebody who has the same gifts that I have, and maybe I'm worried that they're doing it better, and that's what I'm thinking about. I want to be better than them. I want to look better. I want to have more righteousness. Like, I want people to see me more than they see that person. Instead of that, what if we could be so focused on God's purpose, so focused on the big picture that we don't worry about rivalries? Paul continues, verse 18, yes, I will rejoice. For I know that through your prayers and the help of the Spirit of Jesus Christ, this will turn out for my deliverance, as it is my eager expectation and hope that I will not be at all ashamed, but that with full courage, now as always, Christ will be honored in my body, whether by life or by death. For me, to live is Christ, and to die is gain. If I am to live in the flesh, that means fruitful labor for me. Yet which I shall choose, I cannot tell. I am hard-pressed between the two. My desire is to depart and be with Christ, for that is far better. But to remain in the flesh is far more necessary on your account. Convinced of this, I know that I will remain and continue with you all for your progress and joy in the faith, so that in me you may have ample cause to glory in Christ Jesus because of my coming to you again. Paul uses words like I know and I have an eager expectation. And I see those words and they remind me of how the author of Hebrews describes faith in chapter 11, where it says, now faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. And I read Paul's words and they certainly sound like he has assurance and conviction. That he can't see right now where this is going, the end goal, but he knows it's there. He has faith. And at the risk of jumping ahead in our Philippians series, Paul is later going to describe in chapter 4 how we can handle our anxiety. And so we're not going to spend time in that passage, but I do just want to quickly look at how Paul describes what happens in verses 6 and 7. When we bring our anxieties to the Lord, something happens. We get a peace that surpasses all understanding. When I look at Paul's circumstances in prison, possibly facing death, everything that he has been through up to this point, and I see him talk about his joy, his resolve to keep ministering, and that he has peace, doesn't make sense to me. No wonder Paul could write that God will give us a peace that surpasses understanding. He had it. He'd experienced it. And in the most trying circumstances. And I love that Paul here, he's not just being optimistic. You know, I have this kind of defense mechanism when I'm facing really, really difficult situations where I don't want to deal with it. I don't want to think about it. And so I do this thing where I'm kind of like, it'll probably work out, you know? And it might look a little bit like optimism, but it's really just kind of coping. It's just kind of dealing with it by not dealing with it. But that's not what Paul does here. Paul wasn't just hopeful that things work out. Paul actively sought to find, not just the upside, not just the silver lining. Paul actively sought to find God's purpose in any circumstance in his life. You know, a common theme of conversations that I've had over the years in ministry with different people, so often just people looking at their life, looking ahead at where their life is going, and they're worried. Worried about how their life is going to turn out. It's like they're standing at this precipice and they're looking out at all the possibilities of where their life could go from here. Young and old, doesn't matter. And they're looking out at where life can go, and everybody kind of has this one path in front of them where all their kind of hopes and dreams and desires are, and then all these other paths where things don't work out that way. And they go, that's the one that I want. And if I end up in any of those other ones, It's desolation, it's despair, it's failure. And they're worried about it. And they're asking questions, maybe like a young person who's about to graduate from high school, and they're going, I just wanna make sure that I get into the college that I wanna go to, because I don't wanna have to go to a different one, or I don't wanna not go to school at all, right? Or I don't wanna go to a job that I don't love. I have this thing that I think I'm made for, and I wanna do that, but what if my career takes a different turn, and then I end up at a job that I don't love? What if I never find my friends here? What if I never find my people in this place? Or what if I never find that one person that I'm supposed to spend the rest of my life with? What if I don't get married? What if I don't have kids? What if I can't? What if that prodigal child never comes home? What if things don't work out the way that I want? And we get scared. And we get to thinking that we can only have joy in that one outcome, the one that we've planned out, the one that's all our hopes and our dreams. That's the only one where I can have joy. But Paul knew that's not the case. Paul knew that's not what joy is. And Paul, standing at his precipice, you know, Paul's looking out at what's in front of him, and there aren't a lot of paths left. Where Paul's standing, there's not a lot of options anymore. There's basically two. Paul says, I'm either going to die, or I'm going to keep living, and living right now is suffering, so I'm going to keep suffering. That's it. But Paul looked at those two options, and he said, I know God has a purpose in either of these. And if I die, I get to go home and be with him. And in fact, that's the one that I want. Paul was like, I'd rather die. And it's not because he was crazy. It's just because that sounded better than the other option, which was to continue in this state of suffering. But he could look at that one too. And he could go, God has purpose there too. Even if I have to stay and I have to suffer a little longer, God's got a purpose for that. It's that I can continue to minister to you guys and everybody else that I've been discipling and ministering to all along. Paul was able to say in Romans 8:28 that God can work all things together for the good of those who love him. No matter which scenario I end up in, no matter which path my life takes, even if it's not the one that I wanted for myself, God can work all things together for the good of those who love him. Paul knew that joy wasn't dependent on circumstances. It wasn't dependent on going where I thought I wanted to go or where I was supposed to go. That's not what joy is. Paul knew that joy was about following Jesus, about remaining faithful and trusting him no matter where I am. There can be a lot of outcomes in your life where you can be joyful. It doesn't depend on the circumstances. It depends on trusting and following Jesus. But I'll say this, Paul did have, he had one advantage. You know, as Paul is encouraging his readers, encouraging us to have this perspective, Paul did have one unique advantage. Paul, as far as we know, is the only person up to this point who has seen heaven firsthand. Now I'm going to read from a passage where Paul gives his account in 2 Corinthians 12, but I just want to let you know, it sounds like he's talking in the third person about somebody else, and he's not, he's talking about himself. But in 2 Corinthians 12, Paul says this, I know a man in Christ, that's him, who 14 years ago was caught up to the third heaven. Whether in the body or out of the body, I do not know. God knows. And I know that this man was caught up into paradise. Whether in the body or out of the body, I do not know. God knows. And he heard things that cannot be told, which man may not utter. Paul had this experience. And he didn't know if it was a spiritual experience, a vision, or if he was physically taken up to heaven. He doesn't know. He says as much. But he says, I saw it. I saw God's dwelling place. I saw paradise. That place where if you are in Christ, where you will go when you die, I saw it. I can't even describe it. And I want to ask you this question. What does it mean to you that the one who saw heaven was so ready to go back there that he could say, to die is gain? Elsewhere in 2 Corinthians, Paul could say this. Despite all that he had been through, this light and momentary affliction is preparing us for an eternal weight of glory beyond all comparison. Everything that Paul had been through, all of his suffering, he calls it a light and momentary affliction. And I know by my standards, what he went through was not light. It wasn't momentary. But Paul had a different perspective. Paul knew where he was going. And he trusted what God was doing with his pain. And he could say, this affliction is light and momentary. Paul had the opportunity to look ahead and see beyond the veil, to taste glory. And it helped him to endure his suffering. But he isn't the only model for this. And in fact, I would tell you, he's not even the best model for this. Jesus is. In Hebrews chapter 12, the author of Hebrews describes Jesus' recognition of what was ahead of him and how it motivated him when he said this: "Let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, looking to Jesus, the founder and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is seated at the right hand of the throne of God." Jesus faced unimaginable suffering. And his was not only physical, but it was the ultimate spiritual pain of taking all sin, your sin, my sin, the sin of the whole world, on himself and the punishment for it on the cross. And if you have ever felt alone in your pain, I have too. But more importantly, Jesus understands that. And Jesus did not abandon us in our pain. He stepped down into this world to take the ultimate pain of sin and death. And why was he able to do that? Because he knew the purpose. He knew what was ahead. He knew that by doing this, it was part of God's redemption plan, that one day he could restore all things and make everything right, and that there would be this eternal life that all who trusted in him would have with him. Jesus saw the purpose. And the author of Hebrews described it as his joy. So joy doesn't mean the absence of our pain. But joy is what you can have in the midst of your pain when you know it has purpose, when you know the outcome. And if you've trusted in his death on the cross on your behalf, that joy is yours. And if you've never trusted that Jesus died for you and that he rose 3 days later, I would invite you to trust that today. And that joy can be yours. But Paul reminded the Philippians, those fellow brothers and sisters who had trusted in Jesus, that they too could have that joy. And he invited them to live in light of this truth. He continues in verse 27. "Only let your manner of life be worthy of the gospel of Christ, so that whether I come to see you or am absent, I may hear of you that you are standing firm in one spirit, with one mind, striving side by side for the faith of the gospel, and not frightened in anything by your opponents. This is a clear sign to them of their destruction, but of your salvation, and that from God. For it has been granted to you that for the sake of Christ, you should not only believe in him, but also suffer for his sake, engaged in the same conflict that you saw I had, and now hear that I still have." Paul told them, hey, for my life, I could either die and go to be with Jesus, or I could continue suffering, and I can continue working for the gospel and serving you. And I think that's where God's going to have me. I think he's going to keep me here a little longer. And I think I'm going to get to come, and I'm going to get to see you guys again. And when I do, my hope is that I'll find you living the same way, having this same response. Paul hopes that his faith and his steadfastness will encourage a faithful response in the Philippians, who he says are suffering just like him. That in Philippi, they were suffering persecution. They were enduring a lot of the same things that he was. And he's saying, look, I'm suffering and I'm enduring and I'm keeping my eyes on the end goal, and it's helping me to endure, and I encourage you to do the same thing. So Paul teaches them to share in that same perspective, to recognize, hey, I know you're suffering, but God has a purpose for your pain. And if you can trust that, you can endure it. That's what he wants them to know. I think that's what he wants us to know. And so I'll just leave you this morning with a couple questions. The first question is this: have you ever felt like a child in the back seat of a road trip that feels like it will never end. Complaining to God. God, I don't want to do this anymore. It's taking too long. This is too painful. Can we go back? Have you ever been there? I have. I wonder what those circumstances look like for you. Feeling like a child in the back seat. But here's the more important question. The more important question is, can you trust that our Father knows where he's taking us? Can you trust that he knows the destination? That he can't wait to see our faces when we finally get there and we get to see it too? You know, I've told people before that I have this image in my mind of a scenario that I hope that I get one day when I die and I go to be with Jesus. I think that what's going to happen, I think I'm going to have the opportunity to stand with Jesus, and he's going to put his arm around me, and we're going to look back at my whole life, and we're going to see all of it right there. And I'm going to look at those painful areas, those seasons that were really hard, and I'm going to see him with new eyes. And I'm going to be able to look at him, and I'm going to go, I remember that. That was horrible. I hated that. But from here, I can see it looks, it was good. It was good. And I think we'll have that opportunity to see our life with new eyes, and we'll see that pain and that suffering, and we'll be able to recognize, God, you were right. It had a purpose. And maybe I couldn't see it then. Maybe I never saw it in this life, but I see it now. Can you trust that God knows where he's taking us? That he's anxious to see our faces when we get there, that he knows the destination is worth it, that what he's doing is ultimately for our good. Can you trust that God has a purpose for your pain?
You've been listening to the weekly broadcast of Grace Church, an independent Bible teaching church in Wichita Falls, Texas. You can join us Sunday mornings for worship at our campus on Stone Lake Drive in Wichita Falls. Stream services live online at gracechurch.com. Or subscribe to our podcast, published on Apple and Spotify. From all of us at Grace Church, thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.